You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to what we call mixed martial arts.
Mixed mental arts, not mixed martial arts.
I'm also a mixed martial artist, everybody. That was Hunter Mott's. I think you coined that phrase. Either way.
It's like all of these things. I thought I coined it, and then I Googled it, and some Polish guy also is using the term. Well, it's the internet. It's idea sex. Yeah. Somebody's going to come up with everything.
And that's the idea. It's about idea sex, and we're going to try to solve all the world's problems. And we have Stanford professor of sociology, a school I never could have gotten into, Professor Rob Willer on the line, whose many studies have been pretty fascinating reading to me. And Hunter's the one who found you, so...
No, I didn't find you. Again, the internet. One of our listeners tweeted and was like, you should get Rob Willer on. We listen to our listeners because they listen to us.
You guys have had a love affair correspondence. Reading your emails. I mean, Jesus. Hunter's the master at the 15-page email. I was like, I got to get the cliff notes. Professor, welcome. Welcome to the mother of all podcasts. We are happy to have you because you've got some fascinating studies here that can shed some light on, you know, how we can better get ideas to move across, you know, the chasm. I feel like we live in a very polarized, politically at least, a very polarized society, it seems to me. And one of the really cool studies you did was how to frame an argument if you're speaking to a conservative or a liberal. If you're talking about the environment with a liberal, all you need to do is talk about how we are harming the ecosystem and harming little animals. But it's not going to work with a conservative. With a conservative, you start speaking in terms of sanctity. You start speaking in terms of authority. You start speaking in terms of protection. You have a better chance at getting them more sympathetic to your point of view.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Well, first, thanks for having me on the show. That's a pretty excellent rendering of the core idea of our research. My colleague Matt Feinberg and I, a few years ago, became really interested in political polarization, trying to understand why it's so bad in this country and how you can do anything about it, and what could somebody do if they wanted to try to reach across the aisle and be persuasive with someone that wouldn't normally hear their argument. And in doing our research, we right away found that it's helpful to understand that the political divide in our country rests on top of a deeper moral divide, in that liberals tend to have consistently different moral values that they prioritize in their political thinking than conservatives, and vice versa.
So let me stop you, because moral values seems like a very broad term. I wonder if that's so they have different moral values, because I feel as though a lot of times the way to start a conversation, and I'm going to change the way I do it after reading your study, and I'm serious about that, but because what I usually do, and I was talking about this recently, was I say, we all agree, let's just take gun control, that mass shootings are a bad thing. Conservatives and liberals both agree that that's a bad thing. So let's just start by agreeing on what the problem, that that's a problem and that that's a dangerous thing. Now, you have a different idea of how to approach that problem than I do. Can we borrow some ideas from each other to maybe solve this problem?
No.
Is that not the way?
We have to talk about your elephant, Brian. I've been trying to make Brian aware of his elephant.
Wait, what's the elephant?
The John Haidt analogy that the brain is like a rider and an elephant.
Yeah.
So let's talk to Brian about his elephant.
Yeah. Well.
Okay.
Go ahead. Well, go ahead, Rob.
Hunter, do you want to explain the elephant?
Get into my head. Yeah.
No, I think you should take it. I've tried to get through to Brian about his elephant, and I think you should have a go and see.
Well, but let me stick to the point.
No. But this is really the key of Haidt's work, and it's the key of what Rob is talking about.
I want to hear that. What I'm saying is that I just wanted to just stay on track for a second about, and maybe it's the same track, but that would be the same moral qualms about loss of life. So I don't know that we have different moral values. We just have a different approach at solving.
No, but we do have different moral values.
We do.
Yeah.
Okay.
So let me try to clarify, because it's an excellent point. And that's not stupid to approach moral persuasion on that issue of gun control by saying, hey, we all object to this outcome for morally principled reasons, maybe slightly different ones, but, you know, so I don't think that that's that's so wrong. And I wouldn't say our research says that's wrong. But what research, one of the most robust findings in the field of political psychology is this finding that liberals tend to endorse values like equality, fairness, protection from harm, showing care, those kinds of moral concerns tend to be endorsed at higher levels by liberals. And mm-hmm. that doesn't mean that conservatives don't also have those concerns or don't think about those things. You know, if you, you know, allocated cookies in an unfair way between yourself and conservative, like your conservative friend is going to notice that and be pissed off in the same way a liberal might. But it is to say that when people are thinking about judging the moral acts or proposed political policies, you know, out in the world, liberals consider these values more than conservatives. Mm-hmm. Conversely, conservatives tend to do more moral reasoning in terms of values like patriotism, group loyalty, respect for authority, purity, protecting moral sanctity. Mm. And one of the breakthroughs, so John Haidt, psychologists, John Haidt and Jesse Graham are responsible for sort of identifying this moral topography that underlies our political topography. And one of the great breakthroughs of this is that we have only, or many moral psychologists, students, scholars of morality had thought that really it was just all about harm and care and equality and fairness. And these other things didn't really count as moral concerns. But when you ask conservatives, for example, like what's moral, they will often tell you showing proper respect for authority, you know, protecting the purity and sanctity of things. And so we now think of this, I think, more multivalenced, complex moral topography as a more useful one.
Mm. But didn't they, I mean, also, I think it's worth rendering that, you know, part of the reason why they're not recognizing these other intuitions is because they're surrounded by people who think the same way as they do. They're on a liberal campus, and they're surrounded by people who have essentially the very similar morality. And so you're like, this is how morality works, because everybody in my tribe has the same morality.
Mm. Yeah, and if you read moral philosophy from Western philosophers, you're going to overwhelmingly see people say, you know, that a well-reasoned moral argument is one that thinks about doing the greatest good for the greatest number, or distributing valued resources in an equal or fair way, you know? So that's more or less why we have, you know, this divergence in our moral commitments. And what we found in our research was that liberals and conservatives, when they go to make political arguments to one another, they make arguments in terms of these values that they endorse at higher levels than their political counterparts, even when they know that they're supposed to be trying to persuade, you know, across the aisle. We still find that liberals, when we ask them to make arguments for why same-sex marriage should be legal, tended to make arguments in terms of equality and fairness, which are more liberal values. And at a very low rate did they make an argument in terms of a conservative value. And when we had conservatives make arguments to liberals on a classically conservative issue like making English the official language of the U.S., they tended to make arguments in terms of respect for authority and patriotism and group loyalty, loyalty to the nation, you know, and very rarely used the values of the people that they were supposed to be trying to persuade.
It's so funny you said, because when it comes to gay marriage, if I'm talking in favor of gay marriage to a conservative, what I'll say to them a lot of times, and I've gotten some headway, is I don't say to them, because I'm preaching to the choir if I'm talking to a liberal, but for a conservative, if I hit a conservative with the idea that, well, gay marriage is a human right, gay rights are human rights, like Jesus Christ. But when I say, to a conservative, I say, do you really think the state should be involved in the marriage business, that a government bureaucrat should tell you what to do in your bedroom? And then I get a very favorable, it's pretty cool, because it's a good way to get.
But this is also, you can have that. I mean, so this is
the point is I'm a very smart argue. I know how to frame arguments way before
you. I didn't just ask you.
Willer came along.
But even to make you even smarter, Brian, this is, the better you understand your own elephant, the better you'll be able to manipulate other people's elephants to do what you want. So one of the way that I really sort of came to really understand this is by looking at something like abortion. So you have pro-choice and pro-life. Mm-hmm. So we all have these intuitions about, you know, freedom, choice.
Sure.
And we all have these intuitions about, you know, protecting people against harm, care, mm-hmm. right? Pro-life. right? But what's happened is that each group has hooked their cause up to one of these very basic kinds of morality that we all have, these moral intuitions. And that's why the argument never gets anywhere, because it's an argument between freedom and life, which is the oldest argument ever, right? Give me liberty or give me death.
Yeah.
And so it gets nowhere. And yeah. What you have to try and do is you have to try and find ways to budge people's moral intuitions, to let them let go of what they're holding on to morally and attach it to something else.
Yeah, Rob, how would you frame an argument, essentially a pro-life argument, to give a liberal more of a sympathetic understanding? If I were to say, I do this unless I say, yeah, is it possible to be a feminist and be pro-life? I think it is, in terms of you can be all for a meritocracy and women being compensated for their talents in the same way men are. But you also could be a woman who holds in her heart the conviction, based on her religious beliefs, that once those cells begin to divide in a woman, that is a human life. And so by taking that out of her body, it would be considered murder. The same way taking somebody off life support would be murder if you want to get into it, right? So how would you frame that? Is that something you wouldn't even want to touch?
Well, I mean, that's such a tricky one, because there may be no, you know, more polarized issue, you know, more central to the, you know, social platforms of liberals and conservatives or Republican.
Yeah. That's fair.
That did try to.
You're breaking up a little bit, buddy. You're breaking up a little bit.
I would expect that if I did try to reframe the abortion issue towards, you know, going either way, I would probably be unsuccessful. Now, if I was trying to do something like, if we were trying to reframe late term abortion or, you know, or something, some more measured, some policy that is not the whole shebang, maybe we could have some luck. And the way we would do it is to, you know, to look, if we were trying to persuade liberals, you know, for whatever reason, pro-choice, we would look for some way in which restricting access to abortion would, you know, involve caring for people, protecting people from harm, or serving the value of equality. I don't have one that pops to mind.
That's a tough one.
I think it's also, it's a good example of the fact that while liberals and conservatives have these tendencies, you know, they still all have these six things and they're using them differently, right? Because pro-life is a care intuition that conservatives have, and that's not typically where conservatives tend to go.
That's right. Yeah, no, it's a very interesting one. I mean, it's very important, I guess, to keep in mind that, you know, when I say that liberals have these values more, I should say that they endorse them at higher levels mm-hmm. than conservatives, you know, and they're more frequently invoking them in their political reasoning, and vice versa for these more conservative moral values. But that doesn't mean that, you know, conservatives don't sometimes have, you know, strong harm-based moral convictions around, for example, abortion. But, of course, conservatives' views about abortion also have a lot to do with purity, sanctity, and feelings of disgust around aborted fetuses. You know, when conservatives go to agitate on liberal college campuses, they'll bring out, you know, disgusting photographs of aborted fetuses. And that's a kind of moral intuition that liberals are less likely to have. So it's kind of a classic example of what I'm talking about how liberals and conservatives talk past each other.
I think your work is so important right now anyway, just learning how to reframe things, because I think, and I may be wrong about this, but it does feel like we are living in a very polarized time, I mean, politically. It feels like the both sides of the aisle are not speaking to each other at all. You've got the Tea Party, you've got these freshman senators, congressmen saying essentially they're signing a contract that no matter what, they'll never raise taxes. I mean, you've got ideology on both sides. It seems like nobody's talking to each other.
It's a very frustrating situation. By the way, I should try to square the circle by offering an example of how we did this moral reframing. Mm. So just as an example of how one could approach moral persuasion differently, we ran a study where we tried to make a political message for same-sex marriage that would resonate more with conservative values. So we made a pro-same-sex marriage argument in terms of the values of patriotism and loyalty, and compared its effectiveness with conservatives to a more conventional message in terms of equality and fairness. Mm. And so the patriotism message made arguments like gay Americans are proud, patriotic Americans. They serve in the military. They contribute to our economy. They deserve the same rights as all other Americans. And America, America, and go America. Mm. And a message like that, that, you know, was designed to, you know, be very patriotic and resonate with conservatives' values around group loyalty, which I think are, you know, quite reasonable and often very honorable values, it was significantly more persuasive to conservatives than that conventional message, which we don't think moves people at all. Liberals, it didn't really matter what they read. You know, they're already on board for same-sex marriage, as you already noted, Brian. Mm. And so we've tested this with a whole bunch of different issues and find pretty consistent evidence that, you know, this isn't like a silver bullet where you're going to start flipping people on, you know, issues like Obamacare, you know.
Well, you may not be, but Brian will be.
Oh, yeah.
He's
yeah.
going to be changing hearts and minds all across this great land of ours.
You're right. But at least it may create civil discourse where there isn't even that at this point.
Well, yeah, we would love for that to be the case. I mean, to even do this technique, you really have to get into the heads of your political counterpart. Mm-hmm. I mean, my colleague Matt Feinberg and I, that we did this research, when we would write these essays, we would have this experience of you know, thinking through, you know, I mean, I'll just come out and say we're political liberals, and we, you know, it's the first time in our lives that we had a set of conservatives who had different moral and political commitments from ourselves, and think, you know, why would they ever agree with us on this issue, given the things that they hold most dear?
Right.
You know, like, how could I get them to see how my idea on this political position is not crazy and it's maybe even reasonable without having to move them at all on their most deeply held, you know, beliefs, you
yeah.
know, things that you're willing to go out in the world and maybe fight and die for? Because if I try to move them on that too, that's a non-starter, most likely. And that exercise of having to think through somebody else's perspective that deeply was, I think, really good for both of us.
Well, talk a little bit about that, because there are, I think you can define a man, I don't know about a woman, but I'm saying traditionally men in this country, you can define a man on based on what he's willing to fight and die for, in a way. I mean, do you ever come up with those kinds of, you know, those hard lines that all of us, I think men define themselves along those lines. You know, it's about territory. They you know,
some men
every
do,
man
Brian.
Has, well, no, but every man has a line. It can be at the front step of their house where you're not coming
no, Brian,
in without
I think
them,
that's the
without
point.
Them
that's...
sort of, no, men are territorial.
Brian, do I have to pull down my pants? Speaking as a man, that is not, that's the point. I believe that, you know, conflict should be talked out. I believe in general. And that's my moral intuition.
I do too. I'm saying, though, that all of us have a point where that would break down, where you could be pushed to the point where I think...
Reluctantly. I mean, you know, if there's a mad dog coming at you, then you have to shoot at the mad dog. Mm. But I think the larger point, Brian, is this is like what these guys are doing is that they are cutting beneath all of the rationalizations about morality to the core impulses that drive us. These six foundations are like six emotions.
Mm-hmm.
We all have fear. We all have optimism. We all have pessimism. We all have joy. We all have curiosity. But different individuals and different cultures use them very, very differently.
Mm-hmm.
So Americans are massively optimistic. Russians are massively pessimistic. It's not that each does not have the capacity to do the other, but they're using these different common parts of our humanity in very different ways. And so what liberals and conservatives are doing is they all have these six foundations, but they're hooking up to totally different ones, and that's why they often don't speak to each other. So for example...
Oh, I see. That's interesting.
So for example...
So they hold other ones, Professor, they hold other ones in higher regard, right?
Yeah.
In higher priority.
Right. Right.
Okay, like equality is a much higher priority
exactly.
than would be sanctity, than would be...
So, for example, when we talk about, like, your dad, right, we've been playing around with some comedy around how would you convince your dad to believe in global warming,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And let me tell you, Professor, that is an incredibly hard thing to do. Like, Big Mike is not a believer in the warmest...
Well, now he is. He's inherently very... He's inherently very, very suspicious of anybody, especially a sociologist from a liberal academia. He'd be like, "Ah, Jesus, with this guy and his new science."
Yeah,
yeah.
But the along those same lines, like I had to think really hard. What is it that would actually flip Big Mike's mind? And the only thing that I could think of was that essentially it was the Russians.
Yeah.
Like if the Russians wanted global warming, which it's pretty clear the Soviets have for a long time because it would thaw Siberia, then you know maybe Big Mike might be.
Yeah.
Like a little bit nervous and might listen.
Yeah.
We tried that study. We did almost exactly that study. We did an experiment where we made people think that France was a bigger emitter of CO2 than the United States to see if that would lead conservatives who at the time really, really hated France in the wake of the Iraq war. And it didn't work. It didn't work. We also tried to instigate some sort of feeling of competition and rivalry with China, to reach conservatives on climate change and sort of, suggest, we got to beat China in the race to be, a cleaner, fossil fuel free economy and stuff. And haven't gotten that.
Did you find that the resistance came from the religious conviction to an extent that God would never do this to us?
I haven't found that in my own research, but okay. I don't doubt that some people think that. It's too bad, too, because there's this sort of natural marriage between religion and taking action on climate change in some sort of environmental movements in Europe. They kind of argue, we are the stewards of God's earth, and, it's we got to take responsibility for this planet,
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your study with Barack Obama and with the Tea Party enthusiasts, and when you made Barack Obama's face darker, you found that people were more supportive of the Tea Party movement?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to talk with you about that. So we became interested a few years ago in the rise of the Tea Party and, this specifically testing this idea that the rise of the Tea Party stems in part from a rising sense of status anxiety amongst white Americans. This increasing sense that the standing of whites in America is declining or eroding. Why is it declining? We saw that the Tea Party emerged in the wake of the election of the first non-white president in the 200-plus year history of the United States. The rising non-white population, the rising minority population in the U.S. played a key role in his election, and people noticed that. And then also all of that anxiety was kind of catalyzed, I think, by this huge economic crisis we had. So we started doing these experiments. We tried to sort of turn up or down white status anxiety to see if it would lead white Americans to support the Tea Party more when we turned it up. And so one of the first things you'd want to do is, turn up or down this sense that the president is not white. But how the hell do you do that? It's not at all obvious how you could get people to either forget/remember that Barack Obama is African American or biracial or what have you. So what we did was we asked one of our lab managers to take the official presidential photo of Barack Obama and artificially lighten or darken his skin in the photograph. And she did a remarkable job of this. It's actually, if you see them next to each other, you can see that the picture's been doctored. But if you see them in isolation, you just kind of think, oh yeah, that's the official photo of Obama. And what we found is when we showed people this, we showed white Americans this darkened photo of Barack Obama in the context of a celebrity identification task where they had to identify what celebrity they were seeing a photo of. When they saw the darkened picture, they tend to support the Tea Party more.
Hmm. More evidence, by the way, that we are intuitive. More evidence that people are not rational. They are run by their emotions, by their elephant, by their sort of quick thinking, by the idea that they, and I'm looking at the picture now, and it's pretty fascinating. Yeah,
yeah, I think it absolutely is an intuitive reaction. I doubt anybody.
Well, it's tribal. It's tribal. It sounds like we're going to be outnumbered now, and it probably created feelings of people feeling unsafe. What's going to happen when the country's more brown than white? And am I going to have to pay for my past indiscretions collectively? There's a lot of that stuff that goes on, right?
Yeah, we ran a study on almost exactly that idea, too. I mean, I won't bore you with all the studies that we ran, because we ran a gazillion of them. But in another study, we showed people a demographic report on, trends in the makeup of the U.S. in terms of race and ethnicity. And we sort of amped one of them up to kind of, really amplify and underscore the rising minority population. It emphasizes, America will be majority minority, demographers expect sometime in the 2040s, and so on and so on. And we found in that condition of the experiment, whites expressed greater support for the Tea Party, and also that they did so proportional to their increased racial prejudice, which they also reported. But I don't think anybody sat there and said, okay, this is bad for me as a white person. because I care about the group of white people that I belong to having higher relative standing than minority. You know, nobody had that conscious set of thoughts. I mean, not only is that a socially unacceptable thing to admit to others, it's probably unacceptable to even admit to yourself, because it's all like deeply intuitive in nature, these reactions.
And you've picked it up from your culture often without even realizing. It's not that racism is an explicitly taught doctrine. They don't say, okay, you know, right between math and English, you have a class on hating people of different skin colors. The other thing that I wanted to sort of like tie in Brian's point about gun control and also, you know, the long, apparently excessively long email that I sent you that was motivated by enthusiasm more than anything. You know, so we're talking about the Tea Party. You know, there have been a bunch of books that have come out this year sort of about the hillbilly culture. J.D. Vance wrote this great book, Hillbilly Elegy, all about growing up in that culture and how that culture is different from the rest of America. And we
My father's reading that right now.
It's an amazing book. Yeah. And I think, and you know, it really fits very well with everything that Richard Nisbett has done on A Culture of Honor. And I think that's and we've had Joe Henrich talking about cultural evolution. And it seems that a large part of unlocking the mystery of the Trump phenomenon is understanding that hillbilly culture, that Scots-Irish culture, and how those moral foundations play out in their thinking. So
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that, you know, one of my favorite of the new books that's come out this year is this piece by, this book by Arlie Hochschild, Strangers in Their Land. I don't know if you've heard of this one, but Arlie was my colleague when I used to be at Berkeley, and she's a phenomenal social scientist, and she has this metaphor that she worked on with the white working class conservative, working and middle class conservative that she was in dialogue with as she put this book together, the ones that she was studying and interviewing, and she would kind of go back to them and refine this metaphor until she got it right as they saw the world. And it was this metaphor of people sort of lined up, looking up at this mountain with like the American dream, you know, success and prosperity and a good life sitting at the top of it. And these folks feeling like they were waiting in line, following the rules, you know, of queuing, you know, they're like, you know, following the rules of how you get the American dream and waiting patiently, you know, to get what they're promised culturally. And feeling like as they waited in line, people are cutting in front of them. You know, minorities are cutting in front of them. Immigrants are cutting in front of them. And if they look, they can see Democrats, elected politicians, most prominently Barack Obama, is like helping these people cut in line in front of them. And it feels unfair and not right. And then every once in a while, they'll see some people ahead of them, white, educated, liberal elites, turn around and make fun of them for being backwards and racist and close-minded and unintelligent and uneducated. And, you know, when you start to think about it through that lens, which I think is so accurate, growing up in Kansas and South Carolina, I really feel like she has nailed a lot of how the folks I grew up near thought about
that's 100% how they feel. I've talked to a number of them when I travel doing stand-up. That's 100% how they feel.
My mom's from Kansas.
Yeah.
It's a great place. Yeah. And also, by the way,
But you also have liberal academia driving the narrative.
Yep.
And
yep.
not giving them any respect for how they feel. You know, I think a lot of people also feel like the values, sort of you know, I'm not a Christian, but the Christians, the Judeo-Christian values and the Protestant work ethic and all of that stuff, and much of which the values that came from the UK and things like England, those are what built this country, you know? And there's this nostalgia, this fear that we're getting away from the principles and values that are and that won and solved the political problem in Philadelphia back then,
and
right?
Since you've brought up Christianity, I want to segue into something else that Haidt talks a lot about in Happiness Hypothesis, which is that it's very easy to see the splinter in our brother's eye and very hard to see the log in our own. So this culture, it's very easy for them to see the ways in which they've been screwed over, but very hard for them to see the ways in which they're responsible for their own outcomes. And that's what Hillbilly Elegy is really about. It's all the ways that the hillbilly culture sets itself up to fail. And in particular, one of the things he talks about is that you don't value education. You know, J.D. Vance talks about growing up and and them thinking that education is girly. It's for girls. And so, you know, a real man doesn't like spend their time with the nose in the book. And in a knowledge economy, in the information age, that's not going to get you very far. And so there's a reason why they haven't moved up the line. And part of that is the values and attitudes of their own culture, which they didn't create, but have been passed on blindly from generation to generation and made sense in the context of the Scots-Irish and no longer make sense in an information age economy.
So there's a terrific book. Now we're just summarizing books back and forth, back and forth, and together and something very rich. There's a wonderful book by Michelle Lamont, a sociologist, called The Dignity of Working Men, and in it she makes this argument that the white working class, you know, they're sold on this idea of the American dream that if you work hard, you can get ahead, but they're not ahead. And so where do they derive self-esteem? You know, from where do they derive self-esteem? And so they moralize those things that are available to them that they are ahead on. So authenticity, sincerity, saying it like it is, masculinity, loyalty to the family, piety and religiosity, these things, obeyance to the traditional structure of family.
You're breaking up a little bit toward the end there.
Things moralizes because then they have higher, you know, they can reclaim self-esteem. If they
losing you again, pal. Are you on a cell phone?
I am. Yeah.
You cut up a little bit there, but I'm getting your point, yeah. which is that they are sort of adhering to or latching on to that which is available to them, which are the things like reliability, authenticity, masculinity, and all these things that are there because the contract that they had always thought existed, which was put in your time, nose to the grindstone, work hard, and you will get the fruits of the land, has not come to be for a thousand reasons, you know, automation.
Yeah, but again, part of this is their own culture. And I think that's what's being missed here is that these are old cultural impulses. And that's Nisbet's point, right? Mm. Scots-Irish culture evolved in Scotland and, you know, places like Ireland. And it was a herding culture that fundamentally, you know, was about punishing trespassers, being extremely violent, and not valuing education, all of these sorts of things. It's the same herding culture as exists within the Arab world. It's those same basic impulses. And it's the same impulses that exist in African-American cultures. So what these people are dealing with, what they're running up against, is cultural software that they have picked up that has been running for hundreds and hundreds of years. And until they change their values and their intuitions, they're not going to get ahead. They fundamentally have to change their values on education if they want to succeed in the knowledge economy.
Professor, do you find that to be the case in these particular groups, these demographics, where they, if you did a survey, they may not hold education in the same esteem and the same regard as, the Asian cultures?
Well,
Richard
Nisbet has done that research.
He's done that research.
All that research is done. It sits around in a journal and, you know, it's germane to, like, what's going on now.
Sure.
We've all picked up weird cultural things. We've talked about rationalism. That's a weird idea that we all picked up.
Yeah.
Again, they didn't teach us rationalism. There wasn't like, and now you're going to believe that there's a state that's totally separate from feeling that is called being rational, right? But you pick that up from your culture. And
sure.
So that's what this moment in history is about, is we've all picked up these weird moral intuitions, and now we have to see which ones make sense, which ones serve our present needs, and which ones have to change.
What do you think, Professor?
My own perspective on this is that there's a fundamental need for positive self-regard, for self-esteem, and for a feeling that one is seen with respect by the people around oneself. And if one available social hierarchy, even if it's more central to the economy, even if it's more culturally legitimate, like the kind of liberal education-focused hierarchy in America, if it looks like one where you have no possibility of advancement, and there's another one available to you that's maybe a little less legitimate, but it nonetheless it is endorsed by a lot of people, maybe it's even endorsed by the majority of the people around you, you're going to flip to that hierarchy. So if you, in terms of the one that you invest in, the one that you endorse, the one that you tell people is the real basis of respect in the world, or should be.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you're in a world where, you know, you hear from liberals that what makes somebody really qualified to be president is if they went to Harvard, and there's just no way that anybody in your family's got a realistic shot at that. You know, you got no chance at that game. You know, like you're hoping to go to your kids to go to the local state university, and you don't really see what's wrong with that. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. You're going to opt for a different hierarchy, and you're going to call them elitist snobs who also don't really understand the real basis of respect and human value.
Right.
To be clear, I'm not saying that they should all flip and become liberals. I think there are huge problems with liberal culture. You know, Hillary Clinton is a rationalist, you know, par excellence, right? She really believes in technocracy, and there are huge problems with everything that comes out of that, notably in education, because what ends up happening is that you don't engage with these kids in terms of a culture and saying, you have this culture, and there are a lot of awesome things about it, and we should celebrate and keep those things. But there are things that probably aren't going to serve you, and if you think through them a little bit, you'll see that they won't serve you.
Well, so in other words, certain things are outdated, anachronisms.
Yeah. But I think what it all comes down to is, you know, Kennedy had this great thing about Washington, D.C. being a city of Southern efficiency and Northern charm. And that is what the United States is today. It's a country of Southern efficiency and Northern charm. And the opportunity is not for everyone to flip to one culture or the other. It's how do we take the best of both? How do we have a country of Northern efficiency and Southern charm? Because if America can become...
I mean, it sounds like the American way for the most part.
If you can. But would you say that Washington has Northern efficiency?
I don't know.
Would you say that Washington has Southern charm?
I think Washington certainly has southern eating habits
because
it keeps growing.
Yeah.
What I think the value of your work, though, Professor, is that you know, at least I am now able to see how and why someone I disagree with thinks the way they do, so that I don't just paint them with this sort of broad brush that says, you're ignorant, you're an idiot, you're dangerous, you're bad. Well, no, maybe I'd be thinking exactly the same way they would be if I went through what they were going through.
And
I've been very critical of Trump, but not critical of Trump supporters, because I don't know if I was a coal miner in West Virginia, whether or not if I heard Hillary Clinton speaking, she's speaking exactly the way Barack Obama was speaking 8 years ago, I guess, with some nuances. And that didn't work for me. So, of course, I'm going to latch on to, in desperation, a guy who tells it like it is, a guy who looks like me, a guy who's talking about making America great again. You know, I understand that. And I think that one of the important things about your work, it seems, is that you are creating at least an understanding to be a little bit more compassionate, at least to those that we may not agree with.
Well, I really appreciate it. Yeah, if there's one message we would want our work to have, it would be a need for empathy and respect in political dialogue. You know, obviously, we would love to be pushing some sort of clever bipartisan initiatives that would, you know, help get government out of the muck of, you know, deadlock. But I just think it all starts with even having a conversation, you know, like with even just having liberals and conservatives talk to one another with at least some respect and understanding of where one another is coming from, and just begin the conversation. And of course, I would also like to see people, you know, persuade one another and start to develop some political coalitions that could do something.
The problem is that, you know, let's just take academia. It feels like, at least we've had people on the show and things I've read, it feels like the real intolerance is coming from liberal academia. I mean, you can't, my God, if you disagree with anybody, God help you if you're a conservative, and God help you if you have a problem with the new pronouns for transgender people. I'm serious. It's gotten to the point where, you know, you're considered a hate criminal. I mean, there's no cultural appropriation. Some woman in Canada couldn't teach yoga to people who were handicapped because she wasn't Indian. She was culturally misappropriating. You know, this is the kind of bullshit that I lose my mind over. I have no time for it. I really don't. I consider it to be... it's almost like Stalinistic. It's like, you know, these committees that get together and pass judgment. And, you know, I wonder when that happened. When in the world did we get liberal academia and these people in liberal academia who wanted to burn the institution down? They don't want to fix it. They just want to burn it down, man. Am I wrong?
I am a liberal academic, and so I understand well that, you know, the perspective and values, you know, of liberal academics and why, you know, why they say the things they do and why they criticize the things they do. And I really think they mean well too, you know, like they believe they're promoting, you know, tolerance of groups that have been traditionally disadvantaged. They believe they're disproportionately punishing the kinds of words and slander that are made worse.
But Rob, I'm sorry to interrupt you because I know you're getting onto a point, but let me just stop and say something right now. They're wrong, and here's why. There's a fundamental flaw in their thinking, and that is that they think that by bringing down the power structure, the traditional power structure, by putting down the wage earner, by weakening the strong, they're going to strengthen the weak. I'm paraphrasing Abraham Lincoln here. They are wrong. I don't think the world works that way. I think you just make everybody weaker when you do that. And that's the problem with, it seems, the broad strokes thinking that I'm seeing in academia. And I don't have hands-on experience the way you do, so I'm probably being a bit biased here. But when it comes to, for example, if you want to talk about, you know, gender equality and how it's come about organically, look at the MMA world, the UFC. Women's fighting is as exciting today, and I never thought I'd say this, it's as exciting as any man's fighting, and I got something even better for you. Their skill level is almost as good, and in some ways as good as some of the men. I never thought I'd say that out loud. And that's happened in 3 years, 4 years, where you got these badass women out there fighting and with the same kind of ferocity, and more importantly, getting the same kind of enthusiasm from a male audience as if two men are fighting. Now, that's incredible, but they weren't painted as victims, and men weren't treated as oppressors. Be a woman in a fight gym, see what happens. It's not easy, but they've made their place. And so I'm rambling here, and I interrupted you. So please defend you're a communist. Defend yourself immediately, sir.
Yeah, yeah,
sorry. Sorry,
so,
Rob.
I'm my communist comrade.
Yeah.
Comrade. Yeah, we have a plan for
yes.
America.
Exactly.
No, but I think that, you know, like if equality is your central concern and you look out at America and you see many, many failings, you know, many, many cases where equality, you know, is not being served, and you see, you know, one of the sources of that, language, you know, that language encodes and communicates and perpetuates stereotypes that are unfair, you know. You imagine that, you know, you would say and criticize a lot of behaviors that maybe look to you, you know, like, you know, tearing the strong down to create equality. But one thing I would say, I mean, one place where I do agree with you is I feel like, if the rules around the language are too specific and complicated to where you really feel like you need a master's degree from a, you know, an elite university to know them and follow them and to realize your, you know, actual value, you know, to actually communicate that you think everybody has equal worth in society. If those rules get too complicated, you're going to turn away from it because you're going to say, look, there's no winning this. They're just going to judge me a rube no matter what I do.
Well, not only that, so, yeah, that's right.
So I get why those rules are as complicated as they are, because I think the phenomenon that liberal academics are trying to regulate is really complicated really subtle.
They're totally out of touch. And by the way, that's not my problem. The other issue is that I would replace equality, which is a joke, because you guys all talk about equality. It doesn't exist in nature. You know, there are some people that are faster, some people are stronger. I mean, I know that I like the idea of equality of opportunity. I like that.
Right.
I think
right.
that's important. And I also think that, but I also believe in a meritocracy. You know, I mean, I believe in hard work. I believe in smart work. I believe those things matter, and they're what give us the goodies. You know,
I don't think the stereotyped liberal academic we're talking about would you know, particularly disagree with you on that.
Right,
yeah.
Right. I don't either. I'm just getting worked up because I feel like
can I just thank you two for a masterclass in what happens when people's moral intuitions get fired up.
Rob is way more.
He's much more.
He's
calm.
Way more sober. But
I think the important thing is, I think, you know, the big question with all of this is humanity keeps falling into the same traps again and again. We've been doing it for thousands and thousands of years, and the question is, what is that trap? And I think the trap is the human mind. And so, if I may read briefly from the Holy Gospel according to Jonathan Haidt,
and I'm going to disagree with Hunter, and I want you to help me, Rob. But get ready, Rob.
Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. If I could nominate one candidate for biggest obstacle to world peace and social harmony, it would be naive realism, because it is so easily ratcheted up from the individual to the group level. My group is right because we see things as they are. Those who disagree are obviously biased by their religion, their ideology, or their self-interest. Naive realism gives us a world full of good and evil, and this brings us to the most disturbing implication of the sage's advice about hypocrisy. Good and evil do not exist outside of our beliefs about them.
I disagree. I do. I think it's a ridiculous notion. My God. So child abuse, I guess child abuse is something we can, I guess it's open to interpretation. What the fuck are we talking about?
Okay.
This is where religion actually has some value.
Brian, but let me ask you this.
It has value.
Brian, that good and evil do not exist outside of our beliefs about them does not mean that we should not believe that certain things are good and evil.
Right.
I agree with you, but the point is that I have chosen to hook my moral intuitions about care and protection from harm towards protecting children from child abuse. But that doesn't mean that that's a thing that everyone necessarily agree. Clearly, child molesters do not feel the same way.
Yeah, but they're
child molesters. I agree. But the point is that what you have to understand is that what you're dealing with is that if you really want to fix these issues, everybody has to take a look at their elephant and see if their intuitions are placed appropriately. So, for example,
Hold on. Yes, but wait, and Professor Jordan, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're getting really we're becoming big relativists here, and I don't know how you structure society that way, and I certainly don't know how you structure a moral framework this way. We all do know. And Professor, I'm going to let you take this. We all do know the difference between right and wrong and good and evil, don't we? I mean, isn't that what our entire justice system is predicated upon? Yes, there are circumstances, but if we start going down this road, holy cow, where's our anchor?
I mean, I think that's an incredibly difficult question, probably better posed to a moral philosopher who's tried to figure out how you can build up a solid, system of morality that looks something like ours, like our own, from some sort of solid first principles. I don't see what the turtles rest on at the bottom of this, personally.
They rest on nothing. There are no turtles.
But there are.
There aren't even turtles. Oh, yeah. My God.
But the United States is a country,
Brian,
of ideals.
That
there are turtles. I mean, what are we talking about?
Well,
I'm a social psychologist that has to, put on a moral relativist hat for the purposes of doing my research. But then, in my own life, I absolutely have moral values.
Brian, exactly. there's what I'm saying, and there's what you're hearing. Okay, so can we try and unpack that?
Yep.
Okay, so. Do you believe that is what is the challenge of fear? Is the challenge of fear to never be afraid?
Mm-mm.
No, the challenge of fear is what to be afraid of,
mm-hmm.
right? So when am I supposed to be afraid, and when is it appropriate, and when is it inappropriate? Mm-hmm. Is it inappropriate to be afraid of math? Because fear shuts down your thinking.
Right.
So if you're afraid around math, you can't do math. Mm-hmm. So that's an inappropriate use of fear. On the other hand, is it appropriate to be afraid of a snake or a tiger and run away and shit my pants so that I can run faster?
Well, you run. I make myself smaller and I meet that animal halfway.
Well, that's
you know
that's
what I'm
the
saying,
difference.
Rob?
But the point is that there are different responses. But there's
Rob.
The issue is not fear. The issue is when do you use fear. So in the same way, what you're dealing with a thing like gun control is how do you use your moral intuitions. So for example, the liberals are using care, right? They're trying to protect people from harm. They don't want anyone to get hurt, and so they're like, okay, let's just not have any guns, and that way no one can get hurt. That's the underlying thinking. Now there are obviously complex rationalizations on top of that, but that's all they're thinking comes down to. On the other hand, people who like guns are concerned about liberty.
Mm-hmm.
They're like, at any moment, the government can go rogue and essentially try and take away our freedoms. It's happened before in history, and anyone who thinks otherwise is naive.
Mm-hmm.
There are complex rationalizations, and we all pore over the Second Amendment and try to show that it says what we want it to say, but really there are these two different feelings. The challenge is, both moral arguments are understandable, but the actual reality is you have to decide, okay, what is the appropriate moral intuition here? Is there some sort of dividing line? What is the complex? But there's not an absolute morality there. There are different feelings that have been hooked up in different ways. So in the same way, yes, there are things that we can broadly agree on, like child molesters are bad. That is inappropriate. A child should be protected from harm up until a certain age, and then Brian Callen can get his hands on them and do terrible things
when
to them.
When they're 25. Professor, what do you have to say about all that?
Oh, man, I got, I mean,
It'd be funny if you're like, I had nothing.
I don't really have a solution to the moral relativism problem, you know, because it's more a question of what we should believe in than what we do, you know. Like, I'm much more of a scientist about these things, you know, trying to explain the reasons we believe the things we do.
Mm. Well, and that's very valuable. It is. I mean, your research is fascinating because it does show us how influenced we are by how we were brought up, what our belief systems are to begin with when we're approached with a problem, right?
Yeah, that's right. And I mean, I guess that one thing that, you know, I guess I would say one of the big messages from the moral psychology literature is this idea that society, humanity, seems to have resolved this problem of what to anchor morality in terms of some of the same answers you see in Western philosophy of like, okay, well, what rule would serve the greatest good for the greatest number? Mm. Or what rule would equalize opportunity and potentially outcome for individuals? Mm. What rule gives people their just desserts? What rule protects the group from other groups? Which, you know, you can find moral philosophers who will build rationales for specific moral rules on those same kinds of bases. And somehow, without having a really smart philosopher sit down and do it, we collectively in different cultures have also evolved these rules that seem to fit with those underlying rationale. And, you know, some people will tell you it's all biology. Some people will tell you it's all culture. But it's, you know, that's they look functional in that respect. But one thing that I would hasten to point out is this is the moral psychology literature and to some extent the evolutionary psychology literature. But there's a whole other literature in sociology that's very cynical and critical of this assumption that moral rules are necessarily functional. And so from this perspective, you know, sociologists would be quick to point out that moral rules are also the product of more influential elites' interests. And so, you know, ask a feminist how functional the moral prohibitions on women's promiscuity are, or restrictions on moral rules against women having abortions that are prevalent in many cultures. Ask a feminist.
That's a very good point.
Society's interests. You know?
Very good point. Very good point. That's very interesting.
Yeah, it's really interesting, I think, when moral rules are... Yeah, they're more clearly, or a libertarian would say, why is it a moral rule that I'm supposed to pay my taxes? I don't believe that serves the collective welfare. I don't believe that at all. So you know, there's this other perspective on where we get moral rules from that says that they're a product of influential, effective kind of morality projects that that individuals are able to successfully sell to a larger public.
Well, I feel like the answer to that question. Or that problem would be in the Bill of Rights. I mean, the Founding Fathers, to an extent, took that into account, and the answer was an individual should not be beholden to the majority's whims or the majority's sort of notion of what... I mean, there's always going to be a compromise, but the Bill of Rights at least went a long way in protecting those rights, obviously not for black people or women initially...
Right.
But certainly that was used to bolster their status and hopefully to get them into equal status, which hasn't happened yet, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the brilliant things about the Constitution. It's so morally varied and vague.
Mm-hmm.
So much moral material in there that you can latch onto like a toolkit and use it for different purposes, that, you know, the Constitution can, at a certain point in time, be a barrier to the equality of African-Americans, and then later be a tool for the promotion of African-Americans, because there's these different...
Well, they left it so general, right? So life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, those three concepts are so general. You know, you're not even entitled to happiness, but you are entitled to the pursuit of happiness, and that could be anything. That could be, you know, if you like to run 25 miles a day and eat only celery, if that's what your idea of happiness, you have that right, as long as you're not trampling on other people's rights.
But this gets back to what we were talking about with gay marriage. What changed around gay marriage?
Yeah, that was interesting. Hunter was talking about how the Bible hasn't changed at all. You could look at the book of Leviticus and say gay marriage is wrong, or you could look at, you know, love thy neighbor and the New Testament, and you'd use that to bolster your argument. So the book hasn't changed. It's attitudes that have changed.
Exactly. And that's really, I think, what has changed. What changed was attitudes around black people, and a large part of that was things like Uncle Tom's Cabin. And you know,
Will and Grace had a lot to do
with it. Huge. No, absolutely. Yeah. But I think, you know.
I remember I auditioned five times for that show. And I'm friends with many of the actors. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you were doing other work, Brian. You were
I sure was. Episodic bullshit. Keep going.
But the point is that this is where the big difference between the rationalist and intuitionist model comes in. The rationalist looks at the text of things and thinks that somehow things are objective. And the intuitionist understands that what really needs to change are feelings. Like, if I change people's feelings about gay marriage, then that's what matters. And then they will rationalize that in whatever way that they want. They'll go and they'll look at, they'll be like, oh yeah, I thought it was about Leviticus, but now that I look more closely at the New Testament, I see that Jesus said, forget everything you've heard before. It's all about loving thy neighbor as thyself.
And that's kind of what I got from your work, Professor. And if you could maybe, through all your experimentation, can you give us the cliff notes of what you have come to believe about the human brain and the way we make decisions, and maybe how we best can solve these problems? How is it? Is it reframing our arguments? I mean, can you kind of give us your cliff notes here? Because it was pretty fascinating studies.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, obviously the kind of the micro level takeaway from this research is if you want to be persuasive, you need to make a real effort to take the perspective of the person you're talking with and, you know, the person you're trying to target for persuasion. And so if that person has really different values from you, you need to think hard about why they might come to agree with you without forsaking the things that they hold most dear. But there's a kind of larger point in this research and some of the other research that I do, which is that political behavior, the things that motivate people are often, those things that motivate people are often the exact opposite of those things that will make them effective and successful politically. So people get charged up by emotion and outrage, a visceral response to immorality or injustice, and that leads them to engage in the political sphere, to like join a social movement, or even just to vote, you know, or to have conversations like you know, the ones we're having. But then, if you want to actually be persuasive in the political and moral dialogues that you're then motivated to rush into, it takes cold, calculated reason and strategy to be persuasive in those areas. And that dilemma is one that, you know, social movements that want to affect change face all the time. How do you get people to show up for that rally because they're outraged, but then be intelligent and persuasive about the strategies that they deploy at the rally? And it's a dynamic that's just
I'm sorry,
tricky.
But also and with the aim that you want to change hearts and minds on the other side, right?
Right. Yeah, right. I mean, that's where you need to cool down and get out of your own head, your own reasons for being outraged on some issue, and think, okay, wait, why would somebody with a very different set of commitments agree with me? And, you know, I should say that while this is a central message of a lot of my research, I also think reasonable minds can disagree with it as well, that there's something to be said for just, you know, if we could wind back the 20th century and rerun the whole 20th century, would we say that the more effective way to affect equality for women and minorities in America and gay Americans as well would be to strategically sell that equality in terms of conservative moral values around patriotism and purity or something like that? Like, would we say that that's the better way to run the 20th century?
Well, sometimes you need laws. Sometimes you do need the federal government to come in and say, what you're doing is against the law. I mean, sometimes you need that. I mean, I do think we owe a great debt to people like Martin Luther King and the black and, for that matter, white, but mainly black sort of social leaders that risked their own lives and their own freedom to and tugged at our – kind of got us to look in the mirror and say, this is just wrong. Watching dogs and hoses turned on human beings, is this in my country? All that stuff that, you know, we owe a debt to. That seems to have moved the needle, because it forces you to confront your own status, your own privilege, and on the back of who? You know, those are the questions that I think.
And much of the fight against slavery was done by Christians.
Yes, a good
point.
Well,
and that's, I think, the brilliance of the civil rights movement was they navigated this tension of how you take the heat that makes people show up for the movement and then cool it down to adopt a really smart strategy. I mean, that's almost more than you can ask people, but they change more efficiently than we really ever see by enlisting the empathy of, you know, moderate Americans that were potentially.
You're breaking up at the end there, but I'm hearing you. I'm hearing you. Do you think that Hillary Clinton does a good job of reframing arguments? Do you think she's done a good job of, because she's so universally hated by so many different people as being corrupt and untrustworthy, but How does she do it, reframing her arguments?
Well, you know, she does make arguments in terms of patriotism, for sure. That's, you know, that's something that, that she uses. And that's kind of the most obvious way that you see Democratic candidates, when they get the nomination and, you know, they have to turn to the middle and the right of America after they get the nomination and make some sort of arguments that will be persuasive there to, you know, to increase their numbers. You know, this is often, you know, the value that gets targeted first is, you know, I'm going to put on the American flag pin. I'm going to talk about the military more. I might ride around in a tank even, you know. But in truth, you know, Hillary has had a difficult road to hoe, in the sense that she still had to consolidate her base coming out of the nomination cycle, as well as try to, you know, win moderates and maybe some conservative defectors who turned out to be available because of the Trump nomination. She, you know, she really needed to, like, continue consolidating the Bernie base. So she's had a bit of a tricky one, having to play the kind of economic equality card for a certain set of people and then play the patriotism for another set of people. And, you know, it's tricky.
Are you surprised at her recent slip in the polls?
I mean, not in the sense that there, you know, there's this old wisdom that, you know, it's crises that hit on a perceived weakness of a candidate that hurt you the most. So there's this rap on Clinton that she's not trustworthy. And so every time something new happens with the emails, it kind of re-triggers that, you know, that perception. So,
right.
You know, this is consistent with that, you know, folk wisdom, which I think seems plausible. I haven't seen an experiment on that, but sounds very plausible.
Right. Well, Professor, I really appreciate you taking the time, man. I love these conversations. I was just thinking about how privileged I feel that I get to just talk to people like yourself. And I love this podcast, and I owe pretty much all of it to Hunter Motz, who finds smart people who are moving the thought needle forward.
But also Hunter Motz, who listens to his listeners.
Yes.
Yes, who recommended this. And I can't remember who it was that suggested to you, but kudos.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right on. Yeah, it's been a pleasure talking.
Yeah, keep doing what you're doing. And you're always welcome back, because we love talking about this. An hour is never enough time, but we only have the studio for so long.
And
so,
for the record, I should also say that Rob has the greatest Twitter handle of any academic ever.
Which is?
At Ghostface Willa.
Ah, oh, you stud.
Thank you. It's a very formal Twitter handle.
Yeah. At Ghostface
Willa.
Yeah.
Appropriate for a serious academic.
Yeah, exactly.
You sound like a rapper, dude. Yeah, you sound like a rapper with a giant brain.
He has an album. He has an album.
He should. Rob, will you come out to my stand-up if I come up to your neck of the woods? I'd like you. I like academics in the house. It's fun.
Yeah, man. That'd be a pleasure.
You're always welcome, my friend. And you're welcome back here. And thank you again for your work. And keep doing it. Keep us abreast, because we'll have you on anytime. You want to get on and just talk about something? You have a book you want to promote? Let us know. All right?
Thanks. It's been fun.
Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Rob.
Awesome.
Yeah, take care, Hunter.
Thanks. That's another episode, ladies and gentlemen, of Mixed Mental Arts.
Bam.
Damn. Dun, 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 bam, 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 bam. We don't have music, but I just go bam, 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 bam. Guess where I'm going right now?
Where?
To box.
And that's awesome.
I might just spar with a guy, Mexican guy, who is a pro.
Yeah.
And he's going to tap my head around, but not hit me too hard. But it'll make me feel like I'm actually sparring a pro.
That's good.
Which is a huge lie. But yeah. I'm going to get low. He never gets tired. And I end up grabbing onto him and blowing like a fucking steam engine.
Oh, that's
but
good.
But it makes me feel macho, because one day I'm going to solve all my problems the way an honor culture.
Yeah, exactly.
Male
or
does
Brian,
with violence.
Or Brian, you could examine your elephant and you could look at your.
I don't like self-examination. Bye bye, everybody.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.